My name is Ed Goldberg, and I am speaking with Piers Paul Reed. First of all, Piers, welcome to Portland and welcome to KABU.
Delighted to be here.
Piers Paul Reed is a award-winning novelist and nonfiction writer. His first novel, Game in Heaven with Tussie Marks, interesting title, was published in 1966. More recent novels include The Free Frenchman, set in France during the Second World War, a political thriller, Alice in Exile, the story of a young English woman caught up in the Russian Revolution. And I guess you're best known for the story of the Andes survivors, documented the terrible incident in the Andes Mountains with, what was it, a soccer
Alive,
team?
Alive.
Yeah. And that was made into a film in 1993.
Yeah.
So, again, welcome. The title of your current book is The Death of a Pope, and your name is spelled P-I-E-R-S, Paul Reed, R-E-A-D. Yeah. Who's the publisher? I've not seen the publisher.
Ignatius Press.
Ignatius.
San Francisco.
Okay.
Mm.
As I was discussing with you before we went on, this is a tough novel to talk about because, in fact, there's a lot of there's a plot-driven novel. So I'll try to be as leading as possible without actually dancing on the plot. How's
right.
that? Okay.
Okay.
All right. Two of the people that we meet in the book that we follow right all the way through are Juan Uriarte, mm-hmm. who's a Basque,
mm-hmm.
and Kate Ramsey, who's English,
mm-hmm.
and. She first sees him when he's on trial. Now, maybe I should back up and ask one more question about this before. Normally with a novel, why one wrote the novel is either inherently obvious or irrelevant. In a case like this, it seems to be that there's, if not a blatant subtext to the novel, there was a reason you wrote it. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, I mean, lots of different things come into the making of a novel. I mean, I think one of the first ideas, I sat on a jury at the Old Bailey in London, and so I was rather interested in, you know, this division between you, the juror, and the criminal, and what happens afterwards. And actually, the original draft of the novel, Kate wasn't a journalist, she was a member of the jury. For various reasons, she became a journalist. I'm also been very preoccupied all my life. I'm a Roman Catholic, and I've been very preoccupied with the whole business of liberation theology and what is the duty of a Catholic or a Christian towards the poor, and to what lengths do you go to help the poor, to what extent does the end justify the means. And so that is a kind of, if you like, philosophical, political, religious theme that goes through the book. But also, of course, it's a love story. It's a sort of triangular love story. And it's about the very real question of suffering in Africa.
There's a philosophical conundrum that occurred at the end of the book, and I don't want to dwell too heavily on it. That made me wonder whether I actually knew how you felt about things, and I suppose that's a good thing because anything that makes you think or shakes you out of your whatever groove you're in is a good thing. When you thought about the book, did you intend right at the beginning to have made this little surprise at the end? I think you know what I'm talking about. I hope so, in any case.
Yes, I mean, the plot, I knew roughly how it was going to, I knew more or less how it was going to end. I mean, I don't like to have it all worked out, and so the novel's in a straitjacket, and I like it when characters do things you haven't asked them to do and surprise you. And to that extent, you know, I really enjoyed writing the novel, and I think if you don't enjoy writing a novel, people won't enjoy reading it. I like to leave the readers to make up their own mind. I don't like... I'm a Catholic, and I'm a conservative Catholic, really, but I don't want my books to be works of propaganda for one side or the other. I want to lay the evidence, rather like in a trial, lay the evidence before the reader and let the reader make up his or her own mind. I think, actually, in this novel, I've probably given some of the best arguments to people with whom I don't fundamentally agree.
Well, the
devil has all the best tunes.
Isn't that true? Well, that's either an act of great intellectual honesty and integrity, or it just makes a better book, perhaps. You know, it's the bad guys always get the best parts in movies
they
and
do.
In plays, too,
yes.
don't they?
Well, yes.
You remember Iago more than you remember Othello, let's
yes.
face it.
Yes.
Okay. The trial, Juan Uriarte is on trial with two other people, one of whom is, he is a member of ETA, which is the Basque separatist
yes.
organization, and he's on trial with a guy who is a former IRA member,
yes.
may in fact be a member of the real IRA, which
yes.
is still doing the violence in Northern Ireland. It occurred to me that this book is in some ways an accounting of what liberation, quote-unquote liberation movements do and whether they should be held accountable for them. Mm. Was that part of what you intended for us to know?
Yes. I mean, I have to say, when I was young, I was a liberationist. I thought there's terrible suffering in the world, particularly in the Third World. It's the gap between rich and poor is outrageous. Something must be done about it. And I was very tempted by the political solution, the violent solution, you know, expropriate the expropriators. So, I mean, in that sense, I'm a sort of poacher-turned-gamekeeper. I mean, having been like these characters, I can understand how they feel.
Oh, there's no one so zealous as a convert, is there?
Exactly. Yeah.
A lot of this book is about the loss of innocence. Mm. The loss of innocence on a grand scale in the Vatican itself, because this deals with the death of the Pope before the current Pope Benedict XVI came in, John Paul II's death, and the installation of a new Pope. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the characters lose their innocence along the way, too, in one way or another, either historically, given the current events of the relatively current events of the book, or at the time of the action of the book. Loss of innocence is a part of the human condition. Did you want to stress that in this book?
Well, I'm glad you saw that in the book because I think there are people who wouldn't. I mean, innocence is a word that's so rarely used these days because it so scarcely exists anymore. And, you know, this is a love story. It's about Kate's love life, in a sense, and illusion, disillusion, what love is for. There meant to be ambiguities in the book about, you know, exactly what motivates people, you know, particularly when you get idealism and sexual love mixed together. There are often ambiguities which come out, in this case, in the course of the story.
One of the things about religious certainty is that there are no ambiguities, that everything is, it's almost, I don't want to say it's a Manichaean world because that's making it too simple. It's not black or white, yes or no. But at least there are certainties. There are moral certainties in the Catholic Church. Mm. There are moral certainties with any ism and any religion. Mm. But again, you make the best arguments, I think, for the fact that we all dance around in a great gray area. There's no. I don't want to say situational ethics and situational morality, but it's in that ballpark, isn't it? It's like that.
Yes, I mean Kate's uncle. Is a Catholic priest.
Ah, yes, Father Luke, Uncle
Father Luke. And I suppose he's closest to my point of view. He has very strong faith, and he very much believes in the, what you might call the supernatural dimension of the Catholic Church. What I've seen over my lifetime is that when faith fades in the supernatural dimension, and people begin to think, well, it's just, you know, the younger generation just aren't going to buy this, and as Kate, indeed, doesn't buy it in the novel, It's very easy to what you might call rechannel your religious fervor into a kind of social Catholicism, and think, well, forget the Eucharist, but you know, let's have a civil war in El Salvador or something. You see what I mean? I'm not explaining myself very well, but I think that's what the novel's about, in a sense, the collapse of faith in a Catholic. In the supernatural dimension of the Catholic faith.
I'm beginning to think that we're going to talk less about the book and more about moral theology here now, because this is a subject that interests me greatly. And funny that you mentioned the Eucharist. I was just does a lot of loss of faith begin with loss of faith in the transubstantiation during when people take communion in the Catholic Church?
I think so. I think I don't know if you're a Catholic.
No, not at all.
No. I mean, I think...
I'm a Jewish atheist.
Many distinguished Jewish atheists.
Yes.
I think the... You know, was it Tertullian who said, I believe because it's impossible? Or someone said it's better translated as, I believe because it's absurd. I mean, I do think the idea that God became a man and bequeathed us his flesh to eat in the bread of the Eucharist is something that is, on the face of it, absurd. You know, if you were God, would you do that? Would you suffer? Would you? The whole Christian message is difficult to take unless you have this irrational understanding, which we call faith. And I think for the younger generation, the difficulty of believing that, combined with the Church's moral teaching on sex, which since the pill, since, I mean, this has all happened in my lifetime.
And what?
Since the pill and everything, it seems completely absurd that you should just only ever have sex with one person and that within marriage. I mean, I think these two absurdities have coloured the whole outlook of a secular generation towards Christianity and towards the Catholic Church. And that, in a sense, although I hope it's a sort of exciting story, that is what the book is about.
The Catholic Church is not unique in having as one of its tenets that you eat a ritual food, which is in effect eating ritually the body of God, whoever God is in that particular religion. So that I find that less hard to understand than some other things. And one of them is the fact that Jesus himself always placed himself with the poor and downtrodden of the earth, when in fact the Catholic Church has aligned itself so often with the power, with the secular and temporal powers that in the countries that they exist in.
Yes, I mean, I think that's an unfair critique. It's certainly true in many occasions.
Tell me why.
Well, I mean, I've written this book called The Templars, about the Knights Templar and about the Crusades and the Church in the Middle Ages. And actually, the Church in the Middle Ages was very much on the side of the poor and was always trying to stop the poor, the brutish kings and knights from oppressing the poor, and the monasteries did an enormous amount to feed the poor and look after the poor. And, you know, poor law only came into Britain after the Reformation, when there were no monasteries to look after the poor. And all the hospitals in France, and, you know, they're called Hôtel Dieu, which means God's house, because that was the church. In fact, indeed, I would say between the collapse of the Roman Empire and the rise of the modern secular welfare state, you know, particularly in Europe, the Catholic Church did nearly all the welfare, and the prisoners and the sick and the old. And so I think it's been unfair to say that the church has entirely been on the side of the rich and the powerful. And Jesus, although of course he loved the poor, and we must love the poor, and we must do everything we can to help the poor, he was, as the present Pope said in his last encyclical, he was not a Spartacus, he was not a political revolutionary. He absolutely squashed any idea that to be a Christian was to be a political revolution.
Yeah, render it to Caesar.
Yeah. Yeah.
On the other hand, he did drive the money changers out of the temple with a whip.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
that's the Jesus I like.
So, yes.
Yeah. I would like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Piers Paul Reid. And believe it or not, this is a thriller. We will be talking about that a little bit. It's entitled The Death of a Pope, and it's published by Ignatius Press. A lot of this book is about the politics of the Vatican, and I find this endlessly fascinating, because just as I find, Question Time in Parliament fascinating, and just as I find the machinations of the United States Senate fascinating, what we have here is a microcosm within a microcosm within a microcosm, and the politics of that must be pressure-cooked beyond belief when, in fact, it's a bunch of guys in a room trying to decide who the next pope is going to be. Mm. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, there's a slight element of satire in the book. I mean, I think my my portrayal of the liberal cardinal.
So I wasn't laughing for
no
reason.
I've known two liberal cardinals. I'm very fond of them both, but so there's an element of satire there, and in the cardinal secretary, who's the sort of one who loves the costumes and loves the ritual and loves the thing. I mean, I'm not just coming down against liberationists. I'm in a sense, it's a critique of different aspects of
Cardinal
Doornik,
who you just mentioned, is a Dutch cardinal.
Yes,
and Dutch Catholics are another peculiar group.
They're way out.
They're way out. More way out than the Jesuits, even. Why? I mean, I knew that you made him a Dutch Catholic for a reason. Tell us why.
Well, partly because of what you say about the Dutch, but partly because there was no Dutch curial cardinal at the time, and I didn't want to have a nasty libel suit with a cardinal.
Okay, so you chose a category which had no members to make.
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. And which was credible, you know, from the point of view of his attitudes.
Yes. Uriarte himself, who was at one time a priest.
Yes.
And went to South America?
To Salvador.
Salvador, yes, Central America. And became bitten by the liberation theology bug.
Mm.
And eventually wound up renouncing, or not renouncing is too strong a word. He gave up his vows.
Yes.
And was no longer a priest.
To join the guerrillas.
To join the guerrillas. Yeah. Is he based on anybody, or is he an archetype?
Well, he could have I mean, I did a journalistic assignment in El Salvador and looked into the whole business of the involvement of the Jesuits there with the FMLN, isn't it? The mm-hmm. Faribundo Martí.
Faribundo Martí, yes.
And so certainly his character is grounded in what happened there. And he certainly, there could have been someone like Uriarte. In fact, I think there were priests who gave up the vows and joined the Jesuits, to join the guerrillas, because they thought, you know, we can't just sit here sort of preaching peace and things. We've got to commit ourselves and pick up our Kalashnikovs. Mm-hmm. So I think he's a credible character.
Oh, I had no trouble believing him at all.
A charismatic character.
Yes. Well, clearly charismatic, because Kate Ramsey, who's a journalist, allegedly the most cynical people on Earth, is fascinated and attracted to him.
Mm, mm.
Tell us about Kate.
Well, she's sort of, I mean, I would say, you know, she's not charismatic, but she's a typical of a young English girl in England at present, and probably in America too. You know, liberal values, slightly confused. She was brought up a Catholic, but has lost her faith. There are discussions with her uncle about faith in the novel, and she just can't bring herself to believe it. And I would say she's susceptible to religious charlatans, if that's the right word. Don't want to give too much away. But
I understand, yeah.
But looking for a cause, which I think is very nice in young people. I think the young MI5 man, Kotovsky, also is looking for a cause. You know, people have a yearning to do good in their lives and not just devote themselves to sort of selfish enrichment and materialistic ambitions. And I think she was looking for a cause and finds, but perhaps, again, you might say there's a certain sort of cynical anti-feminist theme down there in the novel, which, you know, perhaps she was a bit gullible, but susceptible.
Not at all. I found her open and innocent.
Yes.
What's that word again?
Yes,
she's
innocent.
An innocent person. A person who, even though she's a journalist, has managed to maintain. You know, to me, innocence is the most valuable commodity in the world, and I lament the loss of that everywhere I see it. And I was happy to have her innocence for as long as we had it.
Yeah, I'm very glad you see that, because I agree. I think innocence is a very important human quality.
I agree. I wonder how much your experience as a nonfiction writer informs your fiction writing. How much bleeds from your skills as a nonfiction writer?
Well, I think certainly I'm interested in history, and you know, in politics is really just current history. I studied history at university, and I've written several novels which have been set in history, and particularly around the Second World War. You know, trying to understand through the imagination the Holocaust, the World War, the role Catholics played in all that has always interested me. So I think that bleeds into it. I think in my reportage, like Alive, you know, when I talked to the survivors, I hope I'm able to sort of understand human characters other than just simply as projections of my own personality. Mm-hmm. So I think that affects it.
And any skill set of writing that works in both universes, or
nonfiction is more like a job of work. You know, you've got a job to do. You collect material and you put it together as best you can. And certainly, your understanding of a theme. I mean, I'm writing, researching a book about the Dreyfus Affair. Which, do you know what I mean?
Oh, I certainly do.
Which is extremely interesting, particularly about the relationship between Catholics and Jews.
And Emile Zola
and all that. But that's a job at work. I do the research, but certainly my understanding of Catholicism will enter into the writing of that book, as it entered into the writing of the history of the Templars. Something like, say, I wrote a book on the Chernobyl disaster. Mm-hmm. Catholicism doesn't feature in that at all.
So you're not a one-trick pony, eh?
But as I said before, I think when you're writing fiction, although you have an idea of a plot that may be affected by history or politics or whatever, what you really hope is that the characters take on a life of their own and start behaving in ways. I mean, there are certain things that happened in The Death of the Pope that I hadn't anticipated.
Mm-hmm. There's nothing in here that I would say was out of character or shocking by the end of the book. I mean, just that little twist of philosophical twist at the end that kind of, I guess that snapped my head back a little bit.
Did it?
Yeah, it did.
Well, wait till we're off air till you tell me exactly what you mean.
I understand that. You have no problem making some of your characters unpleasant people. That seems to be part of your reputation, as I researched you a little bit on the web, that you don't mind making your main characters hard to take.
No, I mean, I think there are some unpleasant people in the world. And also, you know, a writer, really, when he creates a character, he's putting something of himself into that character, even if those characters are evil people. So I think a novelist has to understand and even be able to empathize with evil and understand why people are like that evil and think, as St. Thomas More said, you know, there but for the grace of God go I.
Well, it's more than that, isn't it? It's a moral choice. We know the bad way and we know the good way, yeah. And we make a choice every day about what we're going to do.
The danger is in fiction that, you know, as we say, the devil has all the best tunes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Simone Weil, you know, who's a mystical Catholic writer, she said, you know, you know, fiction is always going to make evil seem attractive because it's good people are so boring. And there's an element of truth in that, I think.
I wonder if you'd ever consider doing a book about somebody like William Byrd, who was a Catholic composer who existed in a Protestant era in England, the earliest Protestant eras of England, and managed somehow to avoid being either exiled or beheaded through the power of his music.
Yes.
That seems to be the sort of character that
would appeal to me. Yes, yes. I haven't done much research in that, but I should do.
Yeah. The other one, of course, is Hildegard von Bingen, who was one of the most remarkable human beings that we know of, from the 12th century.
You should write that book.
I don't do well with nonfiction, though.
Do you write fiction?
I do.
Oh, well, I must read it.
Thank you. I'm glad somebody will. Secrets. All novelists like to give their characters secrets, and everybody in this book has a secret. Some of them less savory than others, and all of them come out one way or another at the end. Yes?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I might say a lot of coincidences in the novel, but it all fits in very neatly to not just the plot, but what one of the characters has in mind. And you know, he thinks this is Providence helping him to do what Providence wants him to do. But then, of course, we can't go on. I'll give away the plot.
You mentioned David Kotovsky, and he's an MI5, which is the internal security part of the English Secret Service.
Yes.
And I have to say, at least one, the reason that Uriarte is on trial is because he's accused of acquiring sarin gas. This is very nasty stuff.
Yes.
And that's why MI5 is interested in this trial.
Yes.
I suppose the question that emerges here is, should we be surprised that things like this exist, or should we be surprised that tragedies don't happen more often?
I think it is very frightening to think how relatively easy it would be for terrorists to get hold of that kind of thing. I mean, he has some difficulty in sourcing it. And of course, it's part of the plot, but this happens early on in the novel that he's on trial for trying to obtain this deadly poisonous gas, which can kill many people at once. But he is acquitted because his defense convinces the jury and, of course, convinces Kate. That's for the reader to find out why. Mm-hmm. But it is, in a way, surprising it's very, you know, dirty bombs, all sorts of things, all sorts of potentials for
terrorism. You can make ricin out of castor beans.
I know.
It's stunning.
And we have had cases in Britain of terrorist people trying to do that.
Yeah.
Luckily, they mostly turn out to be fairly incompetent. I mean, obviously not the 9/11 ones, but a lot of them are sort of amateurs, and it just doesn't work.
You know, that's true of crime in general, that the majority of crimes are committed by people who aren't that bright, and I think that's the only thing that saves us. there's a happy note. you talk about the security preparations for the College of Cardinals talking about the Pope. Mm. How much research did you do in that? I know you went to Rome because your book is full of Rome lore, but how much research did you do with the Vatican?
Not much. No, it's mainly imagined. I mean, I got a few things. It's amazing what you can... I mean, the novelist takes a little bit of grit and he hopes makes his pearl around the grit. I mean, I'm not a sort of fanatic for for detail, and I think it's credible. I had a friend who was, when it comes to British intelligence, who was in MI5, and I got him to read the novel, and the only main thing he objected to was that I had had in this draft of the novel the MI5 guy being rather deferential to the MI6 guy, which is foreign intelligence. And he said, no, that wouldn't happen. We would never.
Yeah, that's right.
So there are small things like that. And I did a certain amount of research on the web, actually, about how the conclave works and what happens after the conclave. And as I say, I've known one or two cardinals, so I know, in a way, how they think. But I wouldn't want you to read it as a blueprint about the workings of a conclave, or indeed about the making of Sarin.
Mm-hmm. Most of us will never have that kind of information anyway. No. So, and who knows? I mean, Pope Benedict may live another 30 years, and it'll be a long time before any of us sees another conclave of cardinals. I'm sorry to bring this to a close, but I've been speaking with Piers Paul Reid. His first name is spelled P-I-E-R-S, last name like read a book. Title of the book is Death of a Pope. It's published by Ignatius Press. It's been nice talking to you.
Very nice talking to you. Thank you.